Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 312 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Amanda Dalton speaks with Amanda Whittington about moving from teaching to writing, the cross-fertilisation of poems and drama in her work, and the bold approach she's taken to audio drama in reimagining classic silent films for radio.
Described by Joe Shapcott as a dark, funny, wise, terrifying writer, Amanda Dalton is a poet and playwright with a distinctive and diverse body of work. Her first poetry collection, How to Disappear, was published in 1999, followed by Stray in 2012. Between and beyond these came stage plays, large-scale site-specific productions, and a run of Young People's Theatre with the Royal Exchange Manchester. As a radio dramatist, Amanda's written both original plays and adaptations of classics, among them Orlando, The Summer Book, Howard's End, and intriguingly, reimaginings of German silent horror films The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and Nosferatu. She's held writing residences at Leeds University, Manchester Met, and the Bronte Parsonage Museum, and was Director of Engagement at the Royal Exchange. She lives in Hebden Bridge, and her early credits include Deputy Head Teacher at Leicestershire Comprehensive School. And we're here in Hebden Bridge in Amanda's attic with George, her lovely cat. So, Amanda, can we sort of take you back really to when you were a Deputy Head Teacher, before your writing career took off, I guess? And it's just really interesting how I think writers become writers, because we all have our own route in. There's no set way to do it, is there? So I'm just kind of interested how you got from that point.
Yes, well, I was in my 30s, so I started late, and I'd been an English teacher. I'd always loved poetry. I'd always loved reading it. I think I'd always had an inkling that I'd like to have a go at writing it, but in some ways I think being an English teacher put me off, because I was familiar with a lot of poetry, and I think that made me think, this isn't something that you just sit down and write. This is a real craft, which I still think it is. But I think, if anything, it inhibited me.
Right.
And then I don't really know, to be honest, I to this day don't know what possessed me, but I saw an Arvon Foundation brochure in a library, and I picked it up, and I just started to get rather interested in the idea of going on a course for a week. And I think I was probably a bit drunk when I actually sent the form off. I'd certainly had a few drinks, exhausted at the end of a day's teaching. And I applied to go on a course. And rather stupidly, didn't even go for a starting to write. It was a poetry course.
All right.
And once I was on it, and then on the train to Hebden Bridge, because it was at Lumbank, just up the road from here, I became completely terrified. And when I got there, I was even more terrified, because everybody else on the course was writing, and had been writing, and in some cases were published. So I felt very out of my depth, but I was incredibly lucky. It was a wonderful week. One of the tutors, Carol Sacimerti, was very, very encouraging. Well, they both were, but Carol went the extra mile, really, and put me in touch with a friend of hers back in Leicester, who was a poet, Catherine Byron. And Catherine very generously invited me to join a writing group that she held at her house, which was actually a completely informal group of friends who were all very good published poets. So I went from one terrifying experience to another, but had a huge amount of support and encouragement, and actually ended up writing a lot quite quickly. A couple of years after that, I went on another Arvon course with Vicky Fever and Tony Curtis, the Welsh Tony Curtis, not the Irish one. And Tony was just starting the MA in writing at Glamorgan, and he basically invited me to take a place on it. And it's a distance learning course, so I was able to do it whilst being a deputy head, although it was a bit crazy. And I did it. And I think a combination of those three things, really, that first course, the support of Catherine Byron and her friends, and then doing the MA, meant that I actually went from, it was 93, I think, that very first course, 93, 94. I went from that pretty quickly to doing my first collection.
So you went from not having written at all to going into kind of quite a structured, supportive, but rigorous environment of Arvon, I guess, and the groups you were part of. And You weren't writing sixth form poetry at the age of 16 then, and the sort of the idea of...
No, I wasn't. I probably did a few... I probably flirted with it in a very mild way at various times as a teenager. I think I very quickly realised it wasn't very good. I think I had that kind of critical awareness because I was studying English and then teaching it. I think it kind of gave me that awareness of actually what I was what I'd ever written was just really embarrassing rubbish. And that actually stopped me from doing any more, I think, for a long time. I think I struggle, as do many people, I'm not singling myself out here, but I really do struggle with my internal editor.
Right.
And I think quite often I struggle to get that first draft written before I start working on it. And I absolutely know I can say all the right things intellectually. I know that everybody's first drafts, well, most people's first drafts are rubbish. I know that the real craft comes later usually, etc., etc. But I nevertheless personally still struggle to this day, really, with not, you know, reading two lines. Even before it gets onto the page, when it comes into my head, I'm sort of going, oh, that's absolutely rubbish. I'm not doing that.
So it's the internal critic.
It's the internal critic.
Not even the editor.
You're right, absolutely right. Yeah. I don't even get as far as the editor.
Yeah.
Having said that, I think quite often what actually happens to me is that a deadline or an external structure is the thing that makes me write.
Mm.
And therefore, that way into poetry that I had, all of it was about other people expecting something of me.
Okay, right.
And in a way, I respond better to that.
Yes.
Than to no deadline, nobody going to look at it. It's all about me just doing it and expressing myself. That's the bit I've always found very difficult.
Yes, and I think that sense of what you talked about, a bit like what people call imposter syndrome, is quite prevalent in writers, isn't it? That is what sort of keeps you sat on the chair and keeps you working and working and working until you're confident enough to share it, because it's such an exposing thing to
Absolutely.
Share your work. And I imagine, I don't write poetry, but I imagine poetry as a form is probably about the most exposing form of writing, maybe.
I think in some ways it is. All those little, there's very few tiny black words on a white piece of paper, they really shout at themselves, shout out, don't they?
Yeah.
Because there are so few of them. And that somehow makes each word more noticeable than it might be in a slab of text or in a play. But yeah, the inner editor. I think the imposter syndrome thing's interesting as well, because I do think I've definitely got it.
Yeah.
And I do think a lot of, as you say, probably more writers have it than not. I also think it's gender-based.
Right, yes, that's interesting.
I'm sure there are plenty of men who have imposter syndrome, but I think there are a hell of a lot more women who do.
Yes, I'm sure. I think the kind of themes and territory that female writers have inhabited have not been valued in the way that perhaps they are now becoming more valued. I don't know.
I think that's true. And I think in some ways, I mean, I think it's true of subject matter for any form of writing. And I think for poetry, it's certainly been the case. I remember when I was first starting to write, there were still quite a few men, you know, who were quite scathing about... I remember at the time, the Irish writer Eamon Boland was somebody who was talked about a lot, and a lot of her writing was very domestic.
Mm.
And I remember when I first started writing, it still seemed to be acceptable for there to be a criticism of that, of this notion of, oh, it's writing about very small domestic things is not nearly as significant as writing about shooting and hunting and fishing and men with big guns.
Yeah, and I think in theatre that's prevailed till very, very recently, of the epic play and the political
play
are written by men,
yeah.
And the domestic dramas aren't political, which of course they are, you know, wholly political in a different way, have been not on the big main stages of this country until very, very recently.
Absolutely.
Yeah, interesting. And then poetry kind of took you into playwriting, is that...?
In quite an interesting way, really. So by the time I finished my MA, I'd got the job as centre director for the Arvon Foundation at Lumbank, which is what brought me up to Yorkshire.
That's a dizzy rise from poet knocking on the door
running it. It was a strange one, really, because I would never have even seen the advert in The Guardian, as it was, I think, had I not been to Lumbank as a student, and I'd completely fallen in love with the place, and as many people do going there for a course as a student. And it was at a time when I'd been a deputy for 5 years. I was thinking about moving on. I knew people were expecting me to go onto a headship, and I was feeling more and more like I was living this parallel life to the one I should be living.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'd got the writing bug, but also I just was feeling like I think there's a different kind of life that I want to be living, actually, and it isn't in a school. And my partner was thinking of taking early retirement from teaching. He's got a lot older than me. And so we kind of went for this job in a rather reckless, hysterical fashion, not thinking for a second that we'd even be interviewed, to be honest. And we got the job, which was terrifying, I remember, at the time. But apart from anything else, it was like something like a ridiculous salary drop. I mean, it was, you know, anybody would have said it was career suicide if they were looking on paper at what I'd been doing and what I should be doing next.
Welcome to the arts.
Exactly. And of course, it was probably the best thing I've ever done in terms of making that leap. Mm. And like all those leaps, it was difficult to make, and I was really anxious about it. But I think, interestingly, people often associate me starting to write or getting published or any of those things with that job. And in fact, it wasn't the case. In 4 years, I didn't sit in on a single workshop.
Right.
I could have done, in theory. There just wasn't time.
Too busy.
It was a very, very busy job. And at the time, you lived on site. It's not like that anymore, which we both absolutely loved. I wouldn't have had it any other way. But it was a very immersive experience.
Mm.
And actually, I hardly did any writing while I was there.
Mm.
Most of the writing that became my first collection, I did on the MA. And I did do some writing while I was there, but the bulk of that book was already underway, really.
Mm-hmm.
And at the heart of that first book was a sequence of poems called Room of Leaves. And it is a narrative sequence that tells the story of a true story of a woman who was found dead in what was described as a nest of leaves in a garden in Reading, in the garden of her mother's bungalow. And the story was that she'd lived in this garden for 35 years since being jilted at the altar. And all it said in the article was that she'd been a pharmacist and that she'd been jilted at the altar at the age of 35 and had never returned to the house.
Really?
And she was 70-ish when she died.
Gosh.
And there were one or two other tantalising little bits. And I think I'd had this newspaper cutting since I was a drama English and drama teacher, because I'd always thought we might make a youth theatre show out of it or make it in some way, and we never had. And then when I started writing poetry, I found it and I just wrote a poem which ended up being this sequence. I then read this sequence in its entirety at a poetry reading, because I published it as a pamphlet before the book came out. And a radio producer came up to me afterwards and said something like, that would go well on the radio, or that would make a radio play. And we got talking, and true to form, I didn't do anything about it. And then I saw her again some time later, and she hadn't forgotten about it, so it really encouraged me. And it was made into a radio drama, which was basically the poems, and I just wrote a little bit of dialogue around it and had no idea what I was doing, because I'd never written dialogue. I'd done youth theatre dramas with my colleague and friend when we were teaching back in the day before I was a deputy, but that felt very different.
Yes.
It just felt terrifying. But it's what got me into drama. And I think that what I now can see looking back is I've always written narrative poetry. Not entirely, but almost all of it is telling stories or telling fragments of stories.
Yes, and character is strong as well,
isn't
it? And
often it's
in
voices. And so I think that the notion of writing in lots of different voices from different perspectives, telling bits of story, was always in me. And I think that radio experience encouraged me to, because that radio drama did really well. It got shortlisted for various things, and it went well. So I then got commissioned again. And then not long after that, I went to work at the Royal Exchange Theatre in Manchester as the, at the time, education director. My role changed over the years, but I think that immersed me then into the theatre world. And through that, I probably got a bit bolder about making contacts, which ultimately meant I started to write for theatre as well. But it came from the poetry in the first place.
Right. How do you think, as a poet, that has defined or shaped your playwriting?
I think most directors and producers would say I write very economically, that every word counts. I think there's a kind of, I wouldn't say my writing was poetic, and I don't think it's got highfalutin fancy language.
No.
But I think quite often I'm interested in story that is in some way layered, or that I think you can still have things that are metaphorical, obviously, in drama.
Do you feel that the poetry or playwriting, or is it's all work to you? It's not that you're thinking about them in as particularly different genres, though.
I do think of them. It's interesting. There's things I do with radio that I think radio is closer to poetry than theatre. I think drama is closer to poetry than prose is to poetry. I've written some short stories now and again. I've never wanted to write a novel, and I don't think I ever will. But I think there's something about the way drama works. I don't know that it feels closer to poetry, and obviously you can write verse drama. Not that I ever really have, although I've tinkered with it. I think there's things that I would do in radio that I wouldn't do on stage. So things like an interior voice, which can be a poetic voice, I think can work on radio much more effectively than it tends to work on theatre. And I think also that there's something almost anti-dramatic, if you like, about the dramatic monologue popping up in the middle of a naturalistic drama, or about a narration or whatever popping up. I think it actually slows the action. And I'm very interested, I realise, I don't know why, but I am, in characters, often in characters who are inarticulate, in voices, people who probably can't say much stuff out loud. So actually, that's really how Room of Leaves, the sequence, was used in the drama when I did that very first play, was that the poems became a kind of interior voice. And then in the dialogue, the characters were pretty inarticulate.
Yeah.
And it's that notion that there's a rich inner life, and that that inner life can be expressed through a more poetic form on radio. And I think in theatre that's slightly different. Just thinking a difference for me between the two is I don't start a poem on my laptop, I start it in my notebook. And I don't think I've ever started a play in a notebook. I always go straight to my computer. Definitely different part of my brain. I've been writing a lot of adaptations and dramatisations, some of which are more radical than others, but that's also different from an original drama.
Yes.
It's a different set of skills, up to a point. There's some things that are exactly the same, but it's not entirely the same.
Because you have that piece of raw material, I guess, or very finessed material, but you have something that you're working from. You're not the originator of that piece of work. You're
so in some ways it's easier, and in some ways it's harder. It's different.
And I think what we're talking, sort of looking at an overview of what you're talking about, of poetry, of theatre, of youth work or radio, whatever it is. But what it all comes down to in the end is story, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's interesting. For the Royal Literary Fund work I'm doing at the moment, working at Manchester University in the School of Biological Sciences, which is way out of my comfort zone. I think I was thrown out of sciences when I was in what would now be Year 9. But I find myself talking to the science students about story.
Really?
And sometimes they look at me as if I've lost the plot. So you carry on the reference to story. But they do get it, and because I do think it's true. I think whatever we're doing, and it applies to a science essay, actually, we're still telling a story, aren't we?
We are. Everything is about story, isn't it, really?
It's the way we make sense of the world, or try and make sense of the world, is creating sort of narratives that hold for us, really.
Yeah.
Even if it's a willing suspension of disbelief a lot of the time, it's something about, can I create a narrative around this that works sufficiently for me to be able to cope with it or to buy it?
Yes, I think therapy is about story as well, isn't it? What is my story? And I think that's what writing is. And I guess, do you, this may be something you can't define, and why should you, but do you find you return in this fabulously broad portfolio of work, and do you find you're returning to the same story or a central question or something you're still kind of trying to unpick or discover or tell? Is there anything you can feel that unifies that?
I think the thing, it's not so much a question. I seem, without fully understanding it, to be drawn always to, there's certain themes, if you like. Outsiders is one. My second poetry collection is called Stray, and it's about strays of all kinds, really, and straying from the path. So I think something about the underdog. I'm very interested, I think, in terms of character or voice, I'm interested in the person who doesn't have a voice, but I'm not particularly interested in what what you might call issues led. So mm-hmm. I'm not particularly talking about writing a very overtly political stuff about the underdog, but there's something about giving voice to the ordinary and the overlooked and sometimes the marginalised. Quite a few of my original stories, be they through drama or fragments of narrative in poems, I think tend to be about those kind of voices and people.
Right.
I suppose I write about... I hope I write in a way that is warm without being cloying and naff. Because I suppose I wanted to say I kind of write about love, but I think I probably write about the impossibility of love a lot of the time, or the difficulty of love, and therefore about loneliness and about what that really can mean, I suppose. And I also try and get animals in there somewhere.
All right.
I don't consciously do it, but ever since I was very, very small, I've felt a very strong affinity with all animals, to the point that it's kind of slightly crazy. Something, you know.
Really?
I remember as a child being distraught because a woodlouse was on its back and couldn't seem able to get up. And that was as distressing to me as seeing an old person in the street on their back unable to get up. I didn't kind of differentiate. They both were desperately sad to me and impossible. And I'm not quite that extreme now, but I've always been really interested in other species and in our relationships with them, but also in them for their own sakes, really. And I think quite often animals crop up in one way or another, which is challenging for theatre.
Yes. Well, on that note, I think what a perfect way to say, Amanda Dalton, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was Amanda Dalton in conversation with Amanda Whittington. You can find out more about Amanda Dalton on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 312, which was recorded by Amanda Whittington and produced by Conor McPhee. Coming up in episode 313, Sanjeeda O'Connell considers cottages in Somerset and Amelia Hall takes us to the sea-swept landscapes of nearby Cornwall. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.